Blog Talk Radio.
Okay.
Radio Free Palmer, 89.5 KVRF, presents Mushing Radio, hosted by Robert Forto. Mushing Radio is about dog-powered sports, living in the Great White North, and mushing. Visit our website at mushingradio.com. Here is your host, Robert Forto.
Hello and welcome, everybody. This is Mushing Radio, and my name is Robert Forto. You're listening on KVRF 89.5 here in the Mattsu Valley. RadioFreePalmer.org is our live streaming site, and you can listen to any of our episodes anytime at mushingradio.com. Make sure you follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Just search for Mushing Radio. And we are about a week out from Iditarod now. Everything is over. All the dogs are home. The people are back, and we are getting ready for spring mushing, at least here in the Mattsu Valley. But, man, we're missing some snow. It's about 45 degrees here in Palmer right now, and the roads are wet, and the grass is coming up. So I don't know how much longer we have left on the sleds, but we're going to still talk about mushing. And today's guest is Cindy Abbott. She ran Iditarod this year as a rookie, working with Vern Halter and Dream a Dream Dog Farm. And she is on the line right now, calling in from California, I believe. Cindy, are you there?
I'm here, and yes, I'm calling from Irvine, California.
Irvine, California. How is the weather down there?
It's been in the 80s and sometimes in the 90s the last few days.
Oh, my goodness. So you're about a week out from our Alaska weather now. Have you adjusted already? Are you wearing shorts and sandals this time of year? What's going on?
Actually, at night it gets into the 50s, and I'm cold. I really am a wuss when it comes to cold, so.
Well, that's okay. You know, I'm a wuss when it comes to hot, and I remember going back to Denver a couple of years ago, staying up here in Alaska, and boy, I tell you what, that 100 degrees dang near killed me, and I was only there for a week. So,
yes,
so
people always wonder why I do cold sports if I don't like being cold, and it just happens to be the sports I like.
I know, and I can't wait to talk to you about both sports that you've been involved in the last few years. I'm really interested in that. And when folks hear your name, Cindy Abbott, at least Iditarod folks, they know your story, but I'm sure a lot of other mushing fans may not. So I'm interested in finding out all about your adventures, both in mountain climbing and in mushing as well. So before we get started, Cindy, tell us a little bit about you, who you are and what you're all about.
Well, I'm 55, and I live and work in Irvine, California. I teach at the California State University of Fullerton. I'm a health science instructor. And in 2007, I was diagnosed after 14 years of not getting a diagnosis with a rare disease that's called Wagner's granulomatosis. And it's a non-curable, no cause, no cure, no good treatment. So it wasn't real good news, but at least I figured out what was going on with my body. And so I take about 16 pills a day to manage that.
Wow.
Right before I got diagnosed with that disease, I watched a documentary on Mount Everest and took up big mountain climbing just for the sole purpose of summiting Mount Everest. And then I lost my vision in one eye and was diagnosed with the disease, but subsequently ended up summiting Everest 3 years later.
Wow. You know, that is probably one of the most difficult feats in the world, I can only imagine. And can you give people kind of the quick version of what it takes to get qualified for that? I know you have to – don't you have to kind of set yourself up a few years in advance, you know, make sure you have all your permits and all that? I don't know much about it. What's the process to be able – obviously, you just can't land and all of a sudden just start climbing the next day, can you?
Well, no, and I hadn't even climbed a rock wall in a gymnasium, so I had no technical climbing skills at the time. I was 48 years old, I contacted a private guide, and we started going to some of the biggest mountains in the world training, and then I'd go to rock climbing areas and learn the technical aspects of climbing. And so we gradually worked our way up the mountain, sort of literally by going higher and higher, then the doctors were like, well, we don't think you should be doing this. You know, you already have this, you know, deadly disease, and, you know, you should protect it yourself and, you know, not be doing this stuff. And I said, well, you know, let me take it 10 feet at a time. And I literally did. I don't have a death wish, and I went to every mountain and every climb, fully ready to turn around if anything bizarre started to happen. And so I did. I trained 10 feet at a time mountain climbing, and then ultimately made it to the highest mountain in the world.
That is very cool. When you go up a mountain like that, you have to do it in stages, don't you? I mean, you just don't start at the bottom and work your way up. It takes several weeks to make it to the top, doesn't it?
It took 51 days to make it to the summit above Everest. And, yes, you are correct. If you just flew into Everest base camp on a helicopter and got off, you'd probably be dead by the end of the day. So, yeah, you have to acclimatize. So you go up, shock your body, come back down, let it adapt, go back up higher, shock your body. It's a series of rotations higher and higher.
And you said 51 days. How much time did you spend pretty close to the top? Was it just pretty much up and back a one-day deal, or is it, you know, camping just a few feet from the summit and making your way? I'm sure weather has a lot to do with it than not.
Yeah, weather is definitely, weather. The base camp is at about 17,500 feet, where we live most of the time, and then we take maybe a five-day rotation up to, say, 22,500 feet, stay for 3 days, and then come back down for 5 days, then go back up for 5 days to maybe 23,500 feet. So it was rotations about 5 days up. So we were probably above base camp a total of 15 days.
What was it like when you reached the summit? You know, I can only think about, you know, going up there and placing the flag or whatever people do. What was it like when you at the top there and you looked around and you thought, wow, after all this time, all this effort, I'm really at the top of the world?
You know, it was different than I thought it was going to be. We had been trapped at base camp by a storm, and the jet stream had come back, and we didn't even think we were going to get to summit, and so we just went for it and just took it one camp at a time to see how far we'd get. We kept getting turned around by weather, and finally we got a window along with 140 other climbers, and we all went for it at once. And I was approaching the summit. I was about 100 yards from the summit, and I looked around, and I go, wow, I'm higher than anything else in the world, and what a view and all that. And then all of a sudden I was sort of overcome with this malaise that I was up on the top of this little teeny, the top of Everest, about the size of a pool table. And all these people were standing there flinging their arms around. You're not attached to anything, so one knock of the arm and you're off, you know, a 10,000-foot drop-off. And I wasn't comfortable with that at all. So I actually stepped up on the top and stepped off and stepped down a few feet and planted myself, dug in my crampons under the ice, and to get my rare disease banner photo. I took the National Organization of Rare Disorders banner up there for awareness, for rare disease awareness, because I went 14 years with a disease that there was a diagnosis for, but none of the doctors knew to send me to the I don't know doctors. So my mission became to raise awareness for doctors and people that when you don't know, there's this organization out there you can go to, and they'll send you to the I don't know doctors to get you some answers. So this is now my passion, my mission in life, is to spread the word about National Organization of Rare Disorders. So I got my photo. I had to take my medication for my disease because it had been 12 hours, and I got the heck out of there because a storm was coming in, and it hit right when I started down.
Wow. So obviously you made it okay, but, you know, it's my understanding that a lot of people attempt this and they don't make it to the top. You know, they have one problem after another, whether it be, I'm sure that weather is probably the main culprit for people not making it. Do you have any idea of the percentages that attempt and eventually make it up there?
I don't on the attempts and failures. All I know are success rates, about 3,000 individuals have summited Mount Everest. And about 500 Americans have summited, with about, I think I was the 49th American female to summit Mount Everest.
So it's definitely a very select club then.
Well, yeah, it's about suffering. It really is. You're in a tent, in a sleeping bag. That's it for that whole time you're up there. So in my case, it was 54 days. And so, you know, most people can't. And then the suffering that goes along with your body shutting down, and you're literally dying at a certain altitude. They call it the death zone for a reason.
Wow.
So even if you had all the oxygen in the world, you're still going to die. And so it's a matter of being physically and mentally strong and being able to deal with the elements, Mother Nature, and the suffering. It's suffering.
So your doctors advised you not to go before you attempted this. Did you have any ill effects from your disease? And if so, did you make it out okay afterwards?
When the storm hit, my corneas got froze, but that wasn't because of the disease. But later on, my fingertips turned black, and my disease vascular, my immune system is trying to destroy my blood vessels. That's what my disease is. And
oh, wow.
So we don't know if it was we don't know if it's disease-related or not, but they ended up healing fine, and yeah, I was a little messed up when I got down, but not too bad. No amputation.
I can imagine everybody is. You said the death zone. I would imagine everybody's in pretty bad shape when they finally make it home, aren't they?
You are. You're pretty, after that amount of time, you know, 54 days is a long time to be working up there in that element. And, you know, your body fat's all gone. You haven't been able to eat or sleep. You're pretty much skeletal. And then mentally, you're pretty just exhausted from, you know, it's serious stuff up there. It's, you know, a lot of deaths up there. There were five my year, and that was considered a good year.
Jeez. So let's fast forward a few years, and you tried your next adventure. You're headed up to Alaska to run the Iditarod. Man, what a crazy life that you lead. I can just think, you know, the typical professor sitting in a university somewhere, you know, their quest for adventure might be going surfing or something, but you're out there climbing Everest and attempting Iditarod. So when you came up the first time, you were working with Lance Mackey and the Comeback Kennel, is that right?
Yes.
So how did that go? I'm sure you had to do some qualifiers and you know, get yourself prepared. Had you been on a dog sled before? Did you know much about sled dogs, or was it all brand new to you?
It was all brand new. I mean, I'd done the tour sled riding thing in 2004, you know, on the glacier, and was totally fascinated with it and the dogs. The dogs were amazing. And so after Everest, the only other thing left is the Iditarod. So I did take up mushing for the sole purpose of running the Iditarod. And Lance Mackey's attitude, you can't tell Lance Mackey he can't do something, okay, because
right.
He's going to prove you wrong. And so I contacted him, and I told him that I wanted to do it, and he was like, well, he's Lance Mackey, and he's like, all right, well, come on up, and let's see what you can do. And I don't even snow ski, let alone don't know how to drive a sled or anything else. So let's just say it was a very, very steep learning curve. And, yes, I only made it through one qualifier my first season. The Copper Basin was canceled that year, and then I scratched in a couple others. But it was the UK 300, so it was one of the hardest 300s, at least, that I finished my first race. And so, yeah, that's how my first season started. It was brutal.
So you finally got qualified for Iditarod, and for folks that don't know what that means, at least now, and maybe it was different when you qualified, Cindy, you have to do two 300-mile races and a 150 or a 200 for a total of 750 miles. Is that what it was then, or has the rule changed since then?
That's what it was then.
It was then. So you got qualified, and you attempted your first race in 2013, correct?
Yes.
And, man, what a story there is. I remember being on our Iditarod coverage with Alex Stein last year, and you started off and you know, you looked like everything was going well, but then you had an accident, and you didn't quite know what it was until many, many miles down the trail. Isn't that right?
Yeah, it's sort of wild. You know, I started the race, and I had a little limp, and I really even forgot about it because, you know, mushing, you get your bumps and bruises along the way, you know, and we were at the Millennium, and we were getting ready, you know, it's the week before the race, and And I'm limping a little bit after doing chores and stuff, but I don't think any. I think it's a muscle pull in my groin, a groin pull, right? That's fine. I can run the Iditarod, a little owie. And then right. The first day, I was 20 miles out, and something happened where I ended up sort of doing the splits with my legs on the ice 20 miles from the start line, and it ripped it apart. And I really thought I was going to have to scratch at the first checkpoint in Yetna. And I'm like, oh, my gosh, all this work, all this money, you know, taking out loans and all this stuff, and I'm going to have to scratch at Yetna, really, seriously. So I said, well, you know what, let's go to Squintna. I'll lay down. I'll, you know, rest, see what happens. I could pick up my leg about an inch and a half off the ground, but I could drive my sled okay, and I could take care of the dogs. So in 2013, I literally went from checkpoint to checkpoint, down the steps. Okay, I did that okay. Through the gorge, I did that okay. Down the burn, you know, and I took it checkpoint by checkpoint in a tremendous amount of pain, but I could still do what I needed to do, so I kept going until finally coming into Eagle. I ended up post-holing in some really, really deep snow, and it just ripped apart with the injury to where I couldn't stand anymore. So when I got into the Eagle Island checkpoint, this is now about, I think, 570 miles into the race, I couldn't stand anymore. My body was collapsing on itself, but I could do my dog chores on my hands and knees. So the race officials are watching me go back and forth on my knees, taking two bowls, feeding my dog, coming back, getting two more, get up on my sled, and I leave the checkpoint. And they're like, well, she's doing what she's supposed to be doing. So, but I knew I was going to scratch at Caltech because I didn't know the next section of the trail well enough. And it just for the safety of the dogs. I was in an incredible amount of pain by that. But I did 630 miles. Turns out, after they get me back into Anchorage, I had a broken pelvis the whole time.
Wow. Holy cow. So how bad was the break? I mean, was it debilitating? Obviously, you were in a heck of a lot of pain, but I'm sure there was a lot of adrenaline still pumping through that body as well.
Well, that's what must have got me through, because it was broken in two places and dislocated. It was quite displaced. And so the doctor walked out and goes, I don't know how you're even standing there, let alone just ran 630 miles in the Iditarod. But I'm pretty task-oriented, as most mushers, I think, that especially do the distance racing. You know, pain is sort of the back. You know, you put it away for another
right.
time, and you do what you need to do. You know, you go through your winter, your storm, or whatever it is you need to be dealing with. You deal with your team and your dogs, and the rest of the stuff gets put off, you know, the back burner.
So you had to scratch there in 2013. I would imagine that you went home and collected your thoughts. Was it one of those things, Cindy, we're talking to Cindy Abbott today here on Mushing Radio, where you said, I've got to go do this again. You know, it's something that I've got to reach that goal. Or is it something you really thought about long and hard for a long time, or was it almost an immediate turnaround where you figured, I got to come back this year?
Well, I was trying to get the Nord banner that I held on the summit of Everest under the Burl Arches of Nome, and so I took my banner picture where I scratched out with my team in the snow before Caltech. And I was good with that because we aren't rich. We have to take out loans and, you know, run up credit cards to do this. It's not a cheap sport by any means.
Of course.
And
yeah. So
it was my one shot. 2013 was it, and I was good with that. You know, I put my family through everything. You know, my work had let me off work, and I was good with it. It was what it was. And then my husband, a few months later, put this little pea into my brain. I don't know what he said, but it suggested that there's more loans to be had, or credit card, you know, space on a credit card or whatever. And if I wanted to, I could go try it again. And then that started it all over.
That did start it all over. And then you decided to work with Vern Halter, Iditarod veteran, many Iditarods, many Yukon quests, one heck of an operation right down the street from our house, literally. Definitely a different personality than Lance, isn't it?
Yeah, Lance had taken the year off, so I ended up pairing up with Vern, who, yes, you want to take two mushers at the opposite ends of the spectrum. I think those are the two.
Yes.
And you know what? It's good, because I learned Lance's way, and then I learned Vern's way, and then I put them both together. I think it's an excellent experience.
So you're working here with Vern, and you're also flying back and forth occasionally back home to California. So you're kind of doing the dual resident deal. You're coming up and going back, aren't you?
Yes, I was literally living two lives. Part of this time, I'm actually still teaching at Cal State Fullerton. I'd get done one evening. Next morning, I'd be on a flight to Alaska, do a race or training runs, fly home, give final exams. I mean, I was living two separate lives. It was wild.
I can only imagine, you know, I try to just to work and then try to do the mushing thing in the evening, and that's a chore in of itself. I can imagine flying, you know, 8-9 hour flight back and forth to California each weekend or whatever the plan is. So you're up here. Did you do any more qualifying type races? I know you did the Connect 200 this year. Anything leading up to that or leading up to Iditarod? Did you do Copper Basin or anything else this year?
Well, we were scheduled to do the Northern Lights, and that got canceled, and the Copper Basin wasn't open for sign-ups when we originally made the scheduling plan, and, you know, it sort of opened up later, and, you know, the races, they're filling up within a matter of hours now.
Right.
There's so few races that if you don't know a race is open, you're not going to get in. So we didn't get into the Copper Basin. So really the only race I ran this year was the Knick.
So you were definitely prepared. I mean, 630 miles last year, then, of course, all of your qualifiers the year before leading up to that. So you were definitely you definitely had your time on the runners. But my question is, when you started this year, just 3 weeks ago or so, did you feel prepared? Were you ready? I'm sure, we're going to get into the trail and all that here in just a second. But standing there at that start line, was Cindy Abbott ready to roll?
Cindy Abbott felt so good. It was unbelievable because she didn't have any broken bones. And
right.
I had an awesome dog team. I mean, I started when they changed the route back to the when they decided to run the traditional route, I downsized my team to 14 dogs instead of 16 because I did not need the extra two dogs' power. In fact, as everybody says, the problem was cutting the power on the dogs this year. So I started with 14 amazing dogs. I mean, 8 of the 14 were full-on Jihah leaders. I mean, all of them had finished Iditarod at least once, many of them multiple times. And they're a bunch of big love bugs, too, which I love about the dogs. And I had been training with Vern. I had two sleds. We'd sort of tried to make a special sled for the first part of the race, as everybody knows why. And I felt totally prepared this year. I was ready to roll.
So you're heading down the trail. We have about 5 minutes, but we might go over just a couple, Cindy. You're heading down the trail. Evidently, the trail is real nice till you get over there towards, Finger Lake, Rainy Pass, and then on over the steps. What the heck happened to you and others? It was a tough race from that point on, wasn't it?
Yeah, we knew it was going to be a wild ride, so Vern sort of tried to bulletproof. We had a thicker runner plastic. We had a stubble brush bow. I actually had chains for my runners, so I guess they refer to it as hard locking. I could wrap the chains around my runners to slow my team more down on the ice and the dirt. And so we had prepared for that as much as you could. And it wasn't too crazy. The trail committee did their best, I think, on the steps in trying to make that as safe as they could. And the gorge. I think everybody's seen Jeff King's video of the gorge. I called it the death run. But I could control my team fairly well between the chains and having 14 dogs. I took the tug lines off. And, but it was crazy because there wasn't a lot on the ice bridges and things. And then I started hearing the stories about the broken bones and the scratches. And I got pretty beat up, I have to say. It was hard controlling your team. And I never lost my team. I never let go of those handlebars, which means I took some bangs, you know, on some tree trunks and rocks and ice. I was pretty beat up by the time I got into my dog.
There were pictures of you on Vern's Facebook page. You were posing, so to speak, with the hockey pads on and the helmet. And quite a few folks wore those helmets this year. I know Jeff King had worn one, Jan Steves, and a couple of others were really geared up. Do you think that helped you at all? Were you wearing all of that padding when you were bouncing around off those trees there through the burn?
Yes, I was. I had elbow pads, knee pads, all the hockey pads around the hip and spine area, and the helmet. And I'm very glad I did, because I'm sure I would have been more injured if I hadn't. So that was a really good idea on Vern's part.
So you ended up having to scratch this year. Where was the scratch, and what was the decision? What, you know, what was that final thing where you said, you know what, this is it. I got to call the race.
It was in Roan. It was Roan. After going through the gorge, and then I knew the burn because I'd gone through it the year before, and I knew it was worse. The dogs were in great shape. I knew that they weren't having any problems. It was the sleds, which my sled was in great shape, but in Roan, it was me. I was banged up. I was physically banged up. I had a shoulder injury. The doctor there didn't know if it was a rotator cuff tear or what it was, but it was my main driving braking arm, and I wasn't sure that I was able to protect the team going through the next section. I was really worried about it being just trees and stumps and roots and hearing about the other broken bones and the broken sleds. And I just said, you know what, for the safety of myself and my team, we're going to stop here. We're just going to stop here. And so that's when I scratched.
You had mentioned a little while ago when you summited Everest, and it was about the size of a pool table, and you said, "Man, I've got to get the heck off of here. I'm a little spooked, I guess. I don't know if that's the correct word or not, but there was some mental aspect up there about getting off. How much of it was a mental this year on Iditarod, where you said, "Wow, you know, I'm just kind of spooked." I've heard that story from a lot of different folks, finishers and not, that it literally scared them out there.
It was crazy running. One thing about me is I don't allow emotion in. You know, I deal with the task-oriented part of it, mm-hmm. and you keep the emotion at bay because that tends to interfere with your thinking properly. But I have to say, on the Danzel Gorge run, I did let the emotional part eke in a little bit. And I was really worried we were going to end up in the river and things a few times. And so the mental part eked in, plus my physical condition, my knees were banged up, my shoulder. And so between that, knowing what was coming up, and it was really about my dog. It was just me as a person to risk myself, but I wasn't about to put the dogs at risk. It's my decision. We're a team, but I'm the musher, and it's my decision, you know, to proceed or not if it's safe for the dogs. And the dogs are fine. They would have been fine, I'm sure. You know, they just jump over that stuff. But the sleds and then the chance of losing my sled.
It was like fall training to them. You know, that's what we use is we use the ATVs on those stumpy, rooted trails all the time in the fall, and they get real used to it going through the creeks and all that. So, yeah, the dogs are definitely they're used to it, and my understanding is they all fared pretty well. Cindy, I just have a couple of more questions here. My next question is, you said it's all about the dogs and on how you should proceed or not proceed. Can you give us a little bit of a comparison between that, you know, you're a team now with the dogs and yourself and all of your gear in mushing, but in mountain climbing, I would imagine it's much more individual. I know you are out there with a group, and you have, I guess they're called Sherpas, I'm not sure, that kind of work together with you, but it's more individual than it is in mushing, isn't it?
Well, you call it a group or a team, but quite frankly, you could leave one camp and not see another person till you get into the next camp, just like it is at a checkpoint.
Right.
So you really are climbing by yourself on Everest, for sure. I mean, there's a guide somewhere, you know, up and before or after you, and some Sherpas around, but things happen fast, and, you know, so you've got to be able to take care of yourself. So it's an individual thing. It's an individual sport, long-distance mushing.
So which is tougher? You know, I know you've summited Everest, and that's a huge feat, I imagine, and I'm sure that you said you were okay there at Eagle Island last year. Is Iditarod tougher than Everest or no?
Oh, long-distance sled mushing is much more difficult. There's no question about it. I mean, on the big mountains, I just had to worry about me, so my decisions were based on me. like I just I keep saying, but my decision is for the team, and so there's all
okay.
those variables. Yeah.
So you head back to Alaska, you know, or head back home to Anchorage, to Willow, where Vern's at, and, you know, you're collecting your thoughts again. What's next? Are you still comfortable with where you're at the year before, or is something still need to be conquered out there?
Well, I haven't got my banner under the arches in Nome yet, so... I'm really disappointed that I didn't get to finish the race. But we all know what the weather the trail conditions were like, and I still want to finish Iditarod.
And you know that trail, it got, you know, there was a good section there, middle third was okay, and then that last third really smacked everybody in the face again. So, you know, Iditarod is often talked about kind of in three stages, that first stage there of going through the mountains, and then the second stage there up the river, then, of course, that third stage on the coast, sort of three individual races in of itself. So definitely had a lot of trail ahead of you. Are you thinking about next year? Are you thinking about a few years while you get the financial things in order and all that comes with that? Anybody that does mushing knows that everything revolves around how much we can gather together to do this crazy sport. So it's not something we can just kind of lay out there on a whim, is it?
No, it's not. It takes a whole year of planning. It literally does, and anybody in the sport knows that there's so many details, from the dogs to the drop bags, and then there's the finances of it. I mean, the winner of the Iditarod didn't make enough to pay for running the Iditarod. It's an extremely expensive sport. And we're not rich. I mean, I teach at the state university, and we're a couple hundred thousand dollars in debt from these last few seasons. So, I'm trying to regroup, and I would love to have another shot at the Iditarod and finish it and actually be one of the elite, the super elite, actually, one of the 700-plus people that have crossed the finish line. I'd love to join that group.
You know, you sound to me, Cindy, like just one of those persons that goes to the extreme. Is the only thing left one of those space flights after you get done with this?
How did you know I've said that? Because my husband shudders when people say, "What's next?" And it's like,
that's all that's
well,
left.
Yes, I know. Well, no, not a space shuttle. That, how boring is that? No, I want to walk on the moon.
Oh, there you
I've
go.
I wanted to walk on the moon since I was 16 years old. So if I can get my banner to the moon, and there is a company called SpaceX in L.A. that's got manned shuttle vehicles they're working on. So who knows? But right now, I'd still... You know, I love those dogs. Vern's still got those dogs. They're still up there. They're right up there in Willow. They're not that far away from me. Yeah,
that's
so,
true. Oh, it's only a few-hour flight to come back. So when you guys parted ways, you and Vern, did you kind of leave the door open with him or thinking about something else?
Yeah, Vern's a very, very wise man. Vern's a very wise man. He knows that I was pretty traumatized by scratching. I mean, it's not an easy thing to do to scratch. Everybody that consciously scratched, and I know some people didn't have a choice, their sleds were destroyed or their bodies, but I consciously scratched, and that's pretty brutal for me. And being a rookie, and you know, and I don't my second year being a rookie. So is there anybody who's ever been a rookie three times?
Well, you know,
it's
a tough race, and you know, I've been thinking about becoming a rookie for years, and I know what you mean when you have to do that scratch. I had to scratch on the Kinnick, only 25 miles from the finish, just because of all those variables that come into play. Sometimes you just got to know when to call it, and it's not a bad thing to have to call it. To have to scratch. People do it all the time, so there is definitely nothing necessarily wrong with having to pull out by any stretch of the imagination. So my last point to this interview, Cindy, is I want to talk a little bit about the awareness. I know that's a big point of this. It was you want to make sure that you get that that banner not only on Everest but also there under the Burled Arch. How are you continuing that? What's next on the horizon for that? Do you do work in your local community for that? Do you run a website? Do you raise money? What's the deal with that?
We have a documentary that we've been working on for about 3 years now. We're funding it with, again, money, you know, pulling money from our retirement accounts to make a feature-length documentary called Racing for Life. And it's about my story about going undiagnosed and then getting the diagnosis and taking the banner up Everest and my two now attempts of running the Iditarod to try to get to raise rare disease awareness. So we just figured I'm compelled. It's become my life's mission now to make sure everybody knows about NORD, and there's international organizations too. And so the documentary should be coming out this spring, and so hopefully that'll go somewhere and continue, you know, have something in hard form to continue my mission, whether I can continue physically or not, because my disease can come up at any time and take me down. And I'm always aware of that, and I'm really lucky. There's people with my disease, they can't go out and walk their own dogs. They can't walk them a block. They can't get out of their beds. How am I summoning Everest and you know, running long-distance sled dogs? How am I doing that? So I'm taking advantage of that, and that's the thing. So the documentary is next. And Vern, he's great. He's sort of letting me chill and mull over things and try to figure out and put things back together. Because like you said, it's only been a week. And I don't know. We'll see where I go.
Well, we're looking forward to whatever comes of the story. You know, you're a heck of an inspiration. I know when my wife and I met you for the first time there at the Kinnick 200 musher meeting. I know that you and her met pretty much running a training run out on the trails in the middle of fall. So definitely an inspiration to all of us here, and I'm sure to a lot of folks all over the world, not only mountaineers, but also mushers, and of course, like you said, a lot of folks out there that are dealing with health issues, and sometimes just getting outside and walking the family pooch down the road is their own Everest or their own Iditarod in of itself. So a heck of an inspiration, Cindy. Anything you want to say in parting? Do you have a website, a Facebook page, anything where people can visit?
Yes, I do have it. It's my Facebook is just Cindy Abbott, and it's open to the public and people. I try to keep lots of current photos there. And then I have a website called Reaching Beyond the Clouds. And I also wrote a book after Everest called Reaching Beyond the Clouds, From Undiagnosed to Climbing Mount Everest, that goes into a lot of the personal stuff about my disease and about big mountain climbing. So I have all those things out there. I'm working really, really hard to raise rare disease awareness, and I'm trying to enjoy life also. Because living life, we're all alive now. We don't know what's going to happen. So, you know, my thing is to live life, and I've lived such a fantastic life. I'm so lucky.
Well, you're not only lucky, but you're also very determined, and that's what makes one heck of a good story. And I do appreciate you being on the show today, and we'll definitely keep in touch. And I'll forward this show on over to you so you can post it on your Facebook page or social media or anything you like, okay?
Thanks, and we'll maybe see you on the trail again.
Very good. Cindy Abbott, Iditarod musher, and Everest conqueror, I guess you could call. We'll talk again next time. Goodbye.
Thanks. Have a good night.
Thank you.